Welcome to Don't Call It Jazz, KISU's very own listening hang from a jazz musician's point of view. I am your host, Jonathan Armstrong. I'm a professor of music here at Idaho State University, and I'm also a professional jazz musician. So for these next two episodes of Don't Call It Jazz that I'm airing tonight and then next week, I've edited together a long conversation that I had with a wonderful academic musician and all-around brilliant individual, Dan Atkinson. I've mentioned Dan's name on the show before. He is an ethnomusicologist. He went to University of Washington the same time that I did, and he was getting an ethnomusicology degree, and his thesis was songs that were sung, that were continuing to be sung at Angola State Prison in Louisiana, and he traced back a lot of those gospel songs back to their roots as slave songs and their roots as Christian songs coming out of Scotland. And he talked about what the ramifications of that were in music and in American life and history. Really wonderful human being and an incredibly unique perspective on music and jazz. So you've heard me talk about him on the show. So I've actually played audio from these field recordings of Dan's, and those field recordings also inspired a wonderful saxophonist in the Bay Area, Howard Wiley, and his Angola project. And I've played those recordings in addition. So Dan's not only an academic, but he's also a wonderful saxophonist player, and you'll hear him talk about his time in the Bay Area and in Los Angeles studying with these jazz masters, learning from them and interacting with these incredible people. And he's seen all these incredible artists as well. It's just like a really wonderful, rich perspective on music. And I'm so honored and happy to introduce you listeners, the Don't Call It Jazz listeners, to Dan and the way that the depth of knowledge that he has and the perspective that he has coming as an African-American man working within the jazz world, not only the old school jazz world that's being curated and developed in clubs and in churches, but also the academic world and how he navigates those two worlds. So a really fun conversation. And in addition to talking, I asked him to come up with a list of some of his very favorite jazz recordings that we could play on these two episodes and talk about. So what he did is he broke it into four different sets. He calls it The Music of My Grandparents is the first set, which is music from the 30s and 40s. And the second set is Refinement in the 60s, which is music that was recorded in the 60s. We don't get to the third and the fourth set during today's show, the way that I edited it. You'll hear that next week. So right off the bat, you're going to hear Dan starting to talk about his grandfather, which is a really fascinating story. And the reason it starts so abruptly is I just forgot to push record on Zoom and we were already getting into it. So I had to stop him and actually back him up to talk about his grandfather, which he was sharing such an amazing information on. So here is myself and Dan Atkinson and a bunch of really wonderful music. Enjoy.
When I was a kid, I was really fascinated with my grandparents' generation because they were born into sharecropping families. But when World War II happened, that was a way for a lot of black families to get out of the cycle of poverty they'd been stuck in, particularly in the South. And my grandfather, like I said, he had a useful skill for the federal government. He became a Tuskegee Airman and then did a lot of research with aircraft design and whatnot after the war and was over 30 years in the United States Air Force. So because of that, that brought a little bit of prosperity to the family that, like I was saying, other families who were from the same place where he is from, where I used to go a lot as a kid, they're still stuck in that cycle of poverty, and it's four generations later, you know.
Where is this?
This is North Louisiana.
Louisiana.
In Webster Parish, a place called Cotton Valley. And you know, it's like lead belly country kind of a thing. And but DJ Quick's grandmother is from there as well.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. I know some of his cousins. They kind of look alike, you know. They all have that really pretty hair, light skin, you know. It's really... But I was fascinated with the music from their generation because they were the first ones to really break free from that step and a half away from chattel slavery kind of a thing. And like I was saying with bebop, that, as far as I know, is the first black music, well, and like some of the race music too from the late 30s, that wasn't preoccupied with white acceptance or providing itself for conspicuous consumption. So it was our first, well, some of our first examples of sovereignty. And that's something I really took a lot of pride in, because the music was really fun and really colorful and full of charisma. And my mom would bring home broken Victrolas, and I would try to figure out how to fix them. And I just fell in love with the music that was played on them, and all of the music, because it was all done in one take and it's all popping. And like I was saying before, they go through all the cycles of emotions in a matter of 2.5 minutes. Everybody takes a solo. They're in and out. And
tell me what a Victrola is. I don't know what that is.
Oh, Victrola is the wind-up record player that... it's basically got a pickup on it that's basically like a needle that touches a membrane that goes through like a resonant chamber that like acoustically amplifies the sound without any electronic enhancement. So it's a really kind of a stinted mid-rangey sound. But before they had electricity, that's what they did. You know, it was just potential and kinetic energy in a spring that would provide the spinning. But 78 RPMs, you know, the 10-inch records on shellac. You know, I have a few thousand of them.
Yeah, I can see.
I fell in love with that music and just started collecting it. So this is back, like, when I was a kid in the early to mid-80s, you could get 78s for free, or they were a nickel. People used them for skeet. And, you know, I could get all the Jimmy Lunsford, all the Duke Ellington, all of the Count Basie, Lucky Millinder, Cozy Cole, who else, Chick Webb, all of that stuff. You know, it was readily available and it was everywhere because that stuff was really popular, and especially Jimmy Lunsford. And so that was like the first song that I picked for this to represent, you know, my grandparents' generation. And like it's from, what, 1939 or so? And it's like, that's real race music. That was music that was played by black musicians, that was to be sold to black people, and it had to have that connotation because this is during the Jim Crow era. And so I had this first set that we have as an example of three different types of race music, in air quotes, because the first one is card-carrying race music from the 30s. Then we'll slip forward to hear some Jack McVay, who was an LA musician, playing some jump in the mid-40s, just after the war, where things get a little slicker, a little faster, and they get a little more funk, you know, going on. And that still is the same stuff, but because it was being sold to white people at that time, the name was changed to Rhythm and Blues. Same music.
You mean it was changed from race music to Rhythm and Blues?
Yeah, race music to Rhythm and Blues, because now it was being sold to white people, so it couldn't be called race music anymore, so it could... you know, have more liminality to be sold outside. It was a way for them to break Jim Crow, you know.
Got you. But back in the day, they literally called it race music until there was, like, white money that wanted to buy it, and then they changed the name to Rhythm and Blues. Am I getting that right?
Right. It was race music, that was hillbilly music, and then there was the hit parade, and there was classical music. Those were the basic categories. And hillbillies had their own category, and I have some old hillbilly records that are remarkable. You know, Carter Family and stuff, and all those fiddle and banjo folks from Oklahoma and Arkansas and Missouri. And so it was called race music, so it had that specific category that it was stuck in. And then when white people started showing interest in it and wanting to buy it, they had to change the name to something else. A man named Ralph Peer came up with that term in the early 40s, late 30s, early 40s. Can't remember exactly. I didn't study up for this sort of thing. This is just stuff that I liked, you know?
You're doing great. You're just like off the top of your head. It's remarkable. But you're saying he came up with the term rhythm and blues to replace race music.
Right? Because he's a salesman. It's a marketing term.
Yeah.
And so then, you know, and then fast forward, you get into the mid-1950s, you get guys like Buddy Holly, the Big Bopper, Jerry Lee Lewis, Elvis Presley, Carl Perkins, these white people who were raised with black people in the South or very, you know, close, adjacent. And, you know, there were white guys with the black sound. And so then it wasn't enough to buy black music from black people. They wanted the white guy with the black sound playing black music. And so they had to change the name again because rhythm and blues was associated with black people. So they changed the name to rock and roll. That was coined by Alton Freed in like 1955 or so. And that was the term that became this white music with the black sound, where most people didn't even realize that rock and roll is a black vernacular term for sex. You know, Wynonna Harris is All She Wants to Do Is Rock, or or any of the, what is the smack dab in the middle, you know, let me rock and roll to satisfy my soul. It's the same music. And so we're going to hear those examples, the race music from Jimmy Lunsford, Jack McVay doing some jump blues or R&B, and then Wild Bill Doggett doing some classic early rock and roll, and that would be Honky Tonk. And then, so we're going to hear the first half of that, and then the second half will be the vocal version, which a lot of people aren't really familiar with. But it's really cool because when they sing, when dude sings his part, you know, jazz takes a rock and adds a roll, some Lindy Hop that's not too old. So he's talking about switching up the sound, making it a little bit more modern, but you can still do this 20-year-old dance to it. Right? You know, so it shows the continuity of this music and how old it is and how rich it is. The stuff that's from the 30s is just as valid as the stuff that's brand new in the 50s. And you don't really see that continuity so much anymore. And that was the way that I always thought about the music, because I had learned from these older people who thought that way. And they transcended the genres that the music was put into, because those are designed to make it sellable to people outside of the culture. It does no service to the culture of the music to split it up into genres, because it's so related. I mean, John Coltrane made a significant amount of his money in his younger years playing rock and roll.
Walking the bar. Yeah, absolutely.
Literally, I heard several people tell me those stories when I was, you know, back around in the late 90s, how they could make extra money if they'd make him walk the bar, and people would throw coins in his bell. And he'd be all shy, all, come on, man, and make him get up there and do it, because he didn't want to do that stuff. You could see him being all shy and awkward and not wanting to do it.
Yeah. Wait, can you quickly explain for the audience what walking the bar is?
So, if you're rocking the house, if you're in a bar having a real good time and everybody's getting it going, before the guitar became the center of what we call rock and roll nowadays, it was always tenor saxophone. You listen to all the R&B, all the early rock and roll, all the jump bands, all the stuff going back into the Kansas City tradition. It is run by the tenor saxophone. And because it's got the human voice. It's like it's quintessential. It's a surrogate. And you can go screaming high and all the way down to as low as you really need to go. And you get up on the bar and you get up in people's faces and you channel that spirit, the spirit that is paramount in black music. That is, you liberate that which pains you simply by recognizing its existence. Mm. Free yourself of repression. Even if you can't do anything to solve the problem, you can say, I have this problem and it pains me. And there's someone next to you who can't express it the way that you can, but they sure do know that feeling. Mm. And then feed off of each other's energy. So when you're walking the bar, that's when you're whipping people up into a frenzy. It's like akin to a shout chorus in a church.
Yeah.
Really get people getting happy. They start throwing money. They start drinking. Everybody's making money in the bar if you walk the bar and you do it just right.
Yeah. So like literally picture a tenor saxophone player walking on top of a bar.
I guess I should describe that.
No. I mean, but that's it. Like, but you described the important part of it, which is like the spirit and everything that went behind it. But like the literal image that you're looking at is a tenor player walking on a bar.
And you walk up and down. I don't know if this is true or not, but Percy Heath told me that if they didn't want to walk the bar too much because it would get old, they would strap a bass drum on Tootie or whoever was playing drums that night. Percy would be playing on stage, and they'd send Jimmy and Tootie around the block.
What?
They would go around the block and come back up and see if they could meet and sync back up when they got back to the door again. And I'm like, man, y'all is crazy. It's like, you don't see that kind of stuff happening anymore. Like, they're taking a real risk, right?
Yes, this is true. Although you do see it in New Orleans. Like, I was there in January, and you literally...
New Orleans is Chocolate City, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's all still alive. Like, I was just, I was there and playing some music, and there was a bar, like a happening bar, what you would normally see in a city with, like, you know, you look in, you're like a bunch of young people and people drinking and hanging out and dancing and trying to get with each other. But instead of a jukebox or a DJ, it was a 7-piece band with like a snare drum, bass drum, trumpets, trombones, and all that.
And they're rocking. They got the whole place rocking. They can play the same thing for 2 hours and nobody cares.
Yes, because it's amazing.
Nobody cares.
You want to hear it for a third hour. Okay, so here's that first set. Just as Dan Atkinson said, this is Jimmy Lunceford with Uptown Blues, Jack McVay with Swing Man, and Wild Bill Doggett with Honky Tonk, and then the Honky Tonk vocal version.
Mellow fellow a swinging in the band. He always plays the rhythm, so we call him the Swing Man. He really loves his music, as busy as a bee. And when he starts a mugging, you just shout, mercy me. The whole darn world goes mad when he starts, and he's a killer, diller. He's never missed a beat, he'll swing you out, you see. He's blind, there's a reason why. And even baby sister standing by the band, she's trying to get the feeling to come on like Swing Man. Bye on B-boy, bye on B-boy, bye on B-boy, diabla-ba-loo-ba-la-ba-loo-ba-la. Bye on B-boy, bye on B-boy, bye on B-boy, diabla-ba-loo-ba-la-ba-loo-ba-la. The whole darn world goes mad when he starts, and he's a killer. He's never missed a beat, he'll swing you out, you see. He's blind, there's a reason why. Bye on B-boy, bye on B-boy, bye on B-boy, diabla-ba-loo-ba-la-ba-loo-ba-la. Even baby's sister is standing by the van. She's trying to get the feeling to come on like swing man.
Here to stay. Now when you hear the tenor honk, guitar.
We're back at with Don't Call It Jazz. This is your host, John Armstrong, and I'm very pleased to be joined by one of my favorite people and one of the smartest humans I've ever gotten the chance to hang and talk with. That's all true, man. Every single time I chat with you, I'm just like, why does he know all this stuff? This is Dan Atkinson. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me, man. It's a pleasure, man. You, too, are one of the smartest people I know. You're always reading something crazy. And you've always got something that a nice comeback. There's always a comeback with you.
Here's what I love about that set we just heard, Jimmy Lunceford. First of all, Jimmy Lunceford, I had heard before, but this time when I heard him, man, it's like either Johnny Hodges owes Jimmy Lunceford money or Jimmy Lunceford owes Johnny Hodges money. Because like, tell me about that. Like, because we were talking about this before. That 1930s alto sound, like that sweetness.
It's, man, and that's why I always loved pre-war horns, because they got that big bore, and with that smaller chamber mouthpiece, that larger chamber mouthpiece, yeah. you lose control in some ways, but then you gain it in others if you have the dexterity and the will to sort of play with the parameters of it, the characteristics. Man, I fell in love with the way that those guys played saxophone. And there's so many of them. Tab Smith, it's the thing, they all found, Marshall Royal, they all found a way to do that. And I don't know what it was in the water or whatever, but Earl Bostic even, man, all those cats are just fantastic technicians on the saxophone, all the way through Hank Crawford and Fathead, that really sweet, lilty alto sound. That sounded almost like a viola or a violin in some respects.
Or and we've talked about this before, so this isn't a brand new concept, but when I was looking through and listening through the sets that you were handed, that you gave to me for this show, there's a style to both the composition and the soloing that I'm hearing, and I think a lot of it is just so many of these horn players are in the vocal tradition. Like these Johnny Hodges and Jimmy Lunceford, they sound like vocalists. Like you were talking about, Billie Holiday to you sounds like an alto saxophone. It feels like back these musicians, and it crosses this huge amount of time from 1939 all the way to 1999 with all the music we'll listen to tonight. Right. So many of them are in the vocal tradition, and you can tell they played with vocalists, which is a very rare thing these days, especially in jazz academia.
That, and just for the means of the means of expression that is used in the Afro-American tradition, it's a speech surrogate, because you're trying to convey a relatable feeling for someone else, for a collective, like circular sort of, I don't know how to explain it, but it's a form of communication that's not verbal, where you can convey this feeling of, particularly when you hear that blues, the way the alto player plays, man. So he steps out a little bit, comes right back in, he pulls you with him, and you're like, whether you want to or not, you're going to go along that little ride, especially when you hear a soloist on top of a riff that's going on underneath where everybody's just sort of in it and dragging along. And I never really got to play in bands like that, but even when I was a kid, I was like, it must have been so much fun to play in these bands. And that speech surrogate thing where you're conveying a feeling that other people can feel as well is such a powerful and remarkable skill to have that is not really... It's still around, but not anywhere near like it was. Even when I was a kid, I would go see these older cats, because they were everywhere. They were in every church I went to, that's for sure. And anytime I saw black musicians, there was always somebody in the band who could really do it better than everyone else. And they were allowed to do the do. And everybody else just sort of were glad to be along with the ride, for the ride. And... Yeah, that stuff is just, it's just so remarkable because it's just not, it's just really not that way anymore. Because so much music nowadays is made by individuals to be experienced by individuals. And there isn't that collective people negotiating a process to be absorbed and given back. Like this feedback loop that you get with an audience when you're truly doing it right. And you can sense that, you can sense where the energy is, and you can pull back if you need to. You can add a little more if you need to. You can stir it up and hold it. You know, there's an old alto player in San Francisco named Jules Brassard. I used to hang out with a lot, and he would say, you know, hey, you know, a lot of people, they don't really know how to rock a house, man. You know, that's how he would get this real high voice. And he was right, because Jules knew how to rock a house. I learned so much from him and another guy named Bill Stewart. From Chicago and from also New Orleans, and some guys in Los Angeles like Curtis Amy and a guy named Phil Ferris. They're all gone now. And Buddy Collette, a little bit. He was a little frightening, so I saw him kind of sparingly, but not that he was mean. He was just so good that it freaked me out a little bit. I didn't really know how to deal with that. I was like 19 years old. Like, how does he do all that, you know? Yeah.
I mean, someone else in LA that I got to encounter with is Benny Maupin. Benny Maupin still could, like,
right,
he could do that thing. And if you look at old clips, whether he's playing with the Headhunters or Muon Dishi, or even Horace Silver, when he was playing with that group, he could stand up front and just lead the band. And what, you know, it's, I like what you say about the collective versus the individual. I think that's a really profound point and a really important point, because if you think about what jazz is for the most part these days, is so much of it is being driven from the schools and this academia drive, this academia engine that was put into the music. It really is about, it like took the wrong lesson from Coltrane about self-expression, because to my ears, Coltrane, and we'll listen to him in this next set, Coltrane's self-expression was something about spirituality and reverence, and it was about the collective. It was the whole group going to that place. You're talking about rocking a house. I mean, when you listen to those live recordings of the Village Vanguard, I mean, that quartet rocked the house. They brought the house down.
People would go into fits.
Yes.
Like they would in church. That's why, like in the temple concert, the one that they just released a few years ago, you can hear the anguish and the energy, like say from Emmett Till's mother, you know, like you can hear that. Like, and that's why I picked the stuff in the first set, even like Jack McVeigh, that hopping stuff, the swing man, you know, pushing the rhythm. And, you know, they use words like b-boy in there and stuff.
And to your point, it's like, as someone that's gone through jazz school and currently teaches at a school where I'm like the jazz professor, quote unquote, that concept of feel that you're talking about of dance, because that's the other element of this. Like when you're talking about this through line from Jimmy Lunsford to Wild Bill Doggett, it's like they're all dances. They've all played for dancers. You know, when you're walking the bar, you're trying to get people into a frenzy for dancing. And it's like the music and the dance were one thing. And as they got separated and put into school, it's like the math took over. And then you have to go to your whiteboard and you write your half diminished chord. But I mean, if I may quote the illustrious Thundercat, he said once, if your feel sucks, you suck. And it really is that simple. And it's something that is so under discussed in this modern world of playing jazz music. It's like these people, I can hear them play all up and down the horn and I know what they've done and I know the permutations, you know, I've read the same book, but the feel's not there. And there's no dance. There's no, it's what'd you call it? I already forgot the word you just said.
Oh, well, Balter is Balter. What the negotiation part. That's the fake version where I'm having a good time, right? Isn't that enough? That's not enough, man. I have to hear that too, you know?
Yeah, it's enthusiastic, but it's clumsy.
Right, right. Yeah. You have to accommodate a square in your circle. And that part of the music is something that you don't see so much anymore. Like with black churches back in the day, jazz shows too, you got to show for your money. And like you'd be taken on a ride, and I mean, they could have a bad night, but it could still be a fantastic show because you've seen this person struggle through the process, And there's still a certain level of mastery at work, but it's not like beautiful and flowery and prescribed, right? The whole point is to risk failure and not fail. So when you succeed, everyone was down there with you when you created and released that tension, only barely so. And that's the drama of it.
I think that there's also like, because I don't want to skip over the cultural connection, the spiritual connection here. It's not just that people aren't playing with their hearts. It's that this music came from Black lived experience, and it was communicating that. And to me, what's closer to the jazz that you pick for this playlist than modern jazz, if you will, is the stuff that I used to hear from you guys back at University of Washington. So I remember after my first year at University of Washington, I was almost dropping out. I didn't really understand what was happening. I didn't get what the jazz school was. I didn't get what they were trying to get me to be. And I was a little feral. I mean, I grew up playing in Portland and Vancouver and playing with just a lot of people. And I grew up playing in my my church band, but I grew up Buddhist. So I grew up in a Buddhist band. So I was playing in these Buddhist bands, and the way that they taught was just like, you have to get a rise out of the crowd. So that's like what I was used to as a young kid, but I played out of tune and I was all over the place. I didn't know how to play my saxophone. So I get to college, and after 1 year, I was like, this is stupid. They're trying to force me into this thing and I don't like it. So I almost left. And I tell that story to be like, what got me back in was hanging out with you and hanging out with Cody and Gabe and all these ethnomusicology people. Because when I was, exactly. Because the music I would hear, it's Gabe, right? The guy that did the Turkish music.
Yeah, Skoog, yeah.
Yeah, so I would go to his house, or I would go to your house or Cody's house, and you would play me Turkish music, and you would play me music from Angola State Prison, and you would play this music that you could kind of call folk music, for lack of a better term. Music of the people, or, you know, Cody had a friend that went to Ghana. I forgot.
Went to Ghana a bunch.
He went to Ghana, that's right. I mixed that up. But that kind of music that you played for me had that spirit that I wasn't getting in the classroom. And I'm not trying to disparage my professors, but it seems like when you do listen to the jazz that came from a community, an authentic place, there's a little bit of a quality there that's very similar to hearing some sort of like Turkish band or some Eastern European Balkan band or anything that's from the people, and the performance is meant to give back to the people, that speaks to the people and articulates the experience of the people. It's like, it's not just that they played these bebop lines that we can extract and put in a book and like upload into your brain so that it all sounds like Radiohead Gray. It's like, it's got to be that community experience.
Right. They didn't have time for a veneer.
Great.
And life was too short. There's just the music lives in the moment, and these are people who live in the moment because tomorrow's not promised. So when you do that, particularly in a church on Sunday, that's when you hear the best music. And up until, you know, the 90s, all the best Black musicians came out of the church because that was the one place where we had some measure of control of our lives. And so that really, more than anything, shows our collective potential, despite the fact that it takes a nation of millions, that what we chose to do amongst each other was better than anything that the outside world was willing to tolerate or respect or legitimately say, this is beauty, you know, this is beautiful. It had to be something that fit into their boxes where we didn't quite fit into, so a lot of stuff was tainted. And that's why I fell in love with bebop and the whole process of bebop, because regardless of your skin color or your status in life, if I send a call to you, you can't answer that call. You have to sit down. Yes. And that would be the first time that a Black man could assert himself intellectually anywhere in the United States.
Wow. And that's an incredible concept. I never thought about it like that.
And that music is so, it's really clever. It's a young person's kind of music. You can hear the youngness in it and how optimistic it is and how it looks forward, like Charlie Parker thriving from a riff. It just explodes and tumbles over itself, you know, with this, like, there's this, like, you can feel him leaping, you know?
I love that. Also, there's an element of the old school Charlie Parker recordings with Max Roach where it feels like punk rock too.
Yeah, yeah.
To your point about
dropped. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
Like, the cymbals are just washing everything. Yeah,
And it's a little too fast sometimes for the rhythm section. And so it's just sort of like driving and kinetic. I completely agree.
Yeah, sloppy and yeah.
A young person's music is a good way to put it.
Yeah, they're definitely young people. They're not refined yet, you know. And that stuff, I read that wildness of it and the fact that anybody who is going to be a part of it, if you had to, just like how you realized there was something amiss, you know, the syndrome was around when you went to and you had to call on the funk. You had your own way of solving that problem, right? That wasn't the way, let's say, I was taught to do it, but it doesn't matter. It's part of the human expression of the human condition. So you don't have to come from the same culture to express it. You just have to be ready, willing, and able, which is why I always love Charlie Hayden's work so much with Ornette Coleman, because he doesn't have that same bump that you would hear from someone who grew up in the South or grew up super poor in that way, but he could find his way through the changes and convey emotion and a platform for expression that was like unlike anybody else. And Charlie Hayden was like a wizard with a bass in his hands.
So this next set that you call Refinement in the 60s, we're going to listen to Curtis Amy, who we need to talk about a little bit more.
Right.
John Coltrane, who we talked about before. So Curtis Amy, we're going to hear A Soulful Bee, A Soulful Rose off his 62 album, Way Down. We're going to hear John Coltrane's Nature Boy, which was recorded in 63, 64.
Something like that. It was on the Both Directions at Once that was released last year. The reason why I chose that one is because when it dropped, people were really happy to have another Coltrane album, but then the people in the criticism world or in the academic world were upset, kind of, that it didn't innovate or it didn't add anything new. And it's like, well, you know exactly when this recording was made, and there are several other recordings just before and just after this. So this is how they sounded on that day. This is what they chose to do. So rather than talk about the fact that you're not impressed or surprised because you're appearing into a time capsule, why don't you, busy yourself with the idea that these four highly talented young black men who were raised in Jim Crow America, who were doing something uniquely Afro-American at the highest level, looking towards a possible future that has, for whatever reason, not come to realization. Jazz is so far away from that. That kind of nexus that they created, those four musicians created over that course of time, as a culmination of hundreds of years of experience, you don't really hear that of the music these days. You don't really see the connection. And they don't really talk about any of that. They just, the kind of that beauty that we still know how to do, we still know how to make, but we choose not to because it's not safe and it's not easy. And for him to do Nature Boy that way, a piece that, you know, that was a Nat Cole song for a lot of people. So that's a really mainstream thing for him to do, to take and turn on its end and scramble the eggs a completely different way.
Yeah.
And so that's why I chose that one. And of course I chose Amy, the first piece, just because he was such a nice dude when I got on the scene in Los Angeles, and he wasn't famous because he was an LA guy, but he played soprano in the 60s beautifully. You know, Bobby Hutcherson was in his band. Ray Ayers was in his band. He had some really cool cats.
Marcus Belgrave, it's great to hear him again.
Right, Marcus Belgrave, right. And he's, Marcus Belgrave. And he was like the West Coast guy who didn't sound like the other West Coast guys. He sounded like an East Coast guy. That's where the music starts getting more and more refined, but you can still hear the basis of things all the way back into ragtime to what they were doing in that moment. You can still hear the continuity of the Afro-American black music experience, to coin a phrase, or to take a Nicholas Payton's phrase.
Sure. It was still connected to the culture. It was still connected to the community.
Very much so. Even though it had gone off into its on its own tangent, but on any given night, they could switch back if they wanted to. You can walk in and walk out, and there was nothing was set in stone. The only thing that was limiting was genre. You know, the fact that people would say you can't do that because this is that or that is that. And it doesn't make any sense when to us it's all the same.
Yeah, I'm with you. Like as if, you know, it feels like Jack McVeigh could walk into that, you know, a Roy Hargrove session in the 90s. Oh,
most definitely.
And
it would be so fun.
Yeah, exactly. Because that spirit is there and all the musicians would feel that thing. That's when it's still connected to
our community. And when I saw him, he would tour with Larry Willis, Kumba, Frank Lacey, all these older musicians, and they would have a bunch of fun up there, just giggling and running into each other, and sometimes slipping up, and sometimes like catching themselves because like, oh, we did it this way last time, and we did it the same way this time, but I caught you just, you know, whatever, you know, they were making a game of it. So they were highly efficient, but also like a little raggedy at the same time, you know?
I like that. Yeah, going back to Bebop or Ornette or any of these. Right. And speaking of playfulness, the last song of the set is going to be Ahmad Jamal, who you were just talking about, with his version of Misty, which is like, how could anyone hear the ballad Misty and come up with this arrangement? It's incredible. What a mind, to your point. Here's the next set. Curtis Amy with the soulful beat, A Soulful Rose, John Coltrane with Nature Boy, and Ahmad Jamal with Misty. Thank you. so good. That Misty is so good. I've heard that so many times. You know, I honestly hadn't heard that album Heatwave until you sent that thing to me.
It's I'm on now a huge fan. With Tranquility Awakening and Pershing, you know.
Absolutely. I love it now. I love it. And I just can't get enough of it. And it still boggles the mind how he heard this ballad Misty and he came up with such a complex and beautiful arrangement.
And it's almost effortless the way that it flows. His songs are a lot like how a hip hop producer would, you know, they just mix and match things. They build like Legos, you know. I always loved to see him, how he would do that. You know, like I hear him do the same song 100 different ways, and I was always like excited to see it.
And the thing that I think I only learned recently was how much Miles Davis was inspired by Ahmad Jamal. And when you listen to those Ahmad Jamal records, you really hear it. You hear that first quintet that Miles had with Coltrane and Red Garland and them and Philly
That's
Joe.
That's why Harry Garland.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Ahmad and Errol Garner.
Yeah. And it started the famous thing of Miles stealing people from bands that he loved so he could form his own band.
Right. And so like when you hear like a new rumba on Miles Ahead, that Gil Evans basically took Ahmad Jamal's 10 fingers and Miles is the right pinky.
That's a great point.
And that's all it is, man. And that's why he told me that's why he stopped performing Poinciana, because he knew Miles was going to steal it from him. He didn't play it until they got into a nice spot. He did the recording at the Pershing, and then he became a superstar. Because if you hear, you go on Wolfgang's Vault, and you hear him at the following year at the Newport Festival, he starts the intro to Poinciana, and the women in the front start screaming.
And that's where we're ending tonight's show. Many thanks to Dan Atkinson for all of his incredible wisdom and perspective and brilliance. Just a really fascinating guy and a dear friend. Many thanks to KISU and to Jamin Anderson. Thank you to our sponsor, ISU Credit Union. And join us next week for some more conversation with Dan and some more excellent music. Until then, thank you very much for lending me your ears, and have a wonderful week.